Hello there, and welcome to part four of our five-part series in the book of Jeremiah. We'll be discussing chapters 37 to 39, and this episode is entitled The Imprisonment of Jeremiah. Now, if you've been with us the past 3 weeks in this series, then you know that the key to bringing Jeremiah to life is to understand the historical context of Jeremiah. Today's teaching on chapters 37 to 39 is no different than the last three. We have to talk about the events that led to chapters 37 to 39 in order to appreciate what is found in these writings. So we need to go back, and we need to go way back to understand what led to Jeremiah 37 to 39 being written, and then I believe that we can find something of value here. So let's go back to 1000 BCE when a man named David is on the throne of Israel, which would be later known as Judah. 17 kings after David, there was a king who was born, a man named Josiah, who took the throne in 640 BCE. Now Josiah was considered to be a good king. The people of Judah trusted him. They believed in the political system. And there was this sense of optimism and joy and pride that swept through the nation of Judah when Josiah was on the throne. But during Josiah's reign, there were three military superpowers that surrounded the nation of Judah. To the north, there was Assyria. To the east, there was Babylon. And to the southwest was Egypt. Now, these three nations were often at war with each other, and right between all three of them was the nation of Judah. So in 609 BCE, Egypt and Assyria clashed in the Battle of Megiddo, and Megiddo was in the nation of Judah. Now, as you can imagine, if you're a nation where a war is happening between two very powerful nations, then you have to get involved in the battle. And so Judah got involved in the battle, and they picked the side of the Assyrians, which means that Josiah goes out to battle against the Egyptians. And we read in 2 Kings how Josiah goes out to battle the Egyptians at the Battle of Megiddo, and he is struck down by one of Pharaoh's archers, and he dies in battle. The Egyptians keep fighting, and they keep pressing against the Assyrians, and they eventually are victorious over the Assyrians at the Battle of Megiddo. They chase the Assyrians back to the north, back to their homeland, and seek to vanquish the Assyrians. And after this point forward, the Assyrian Empire is never the same throughout history. While the Egyptians are gone chasing the Assyrians, Judah is in mourning. Their king, Josiah, who was quite popular with the people, was killed in battle. Shortly after this death, with tears still in their eyes, they turn to Josiah's son, a man named Jehoahaz, and crown him king over Judah. Unfortunately, Jehoahaz reigns for only 3 months. And that's because the Egyptians, on their way back from conquering the Assyrians, stop in Judah. They see a new king on the throne, and they look at the people of Judah and say, "We did not approve of this. Remember, we conquered you? Well, we get to decide who your king is." So the Egyptians rip Jehoahaz off the throne and install another king who is also Josiah's son, a man named Jehoiakim, on the throne. When they place him on the throne, they say, "You need to tax your people, the people of Judah, so that they can replenish our army. They can help fund our army. In exchange, we'll offer you protection for your taxes." So Jehoiakim, being installed by the Egyptian Empire, turns to the people of Judah, this brand new king, and to the people of Judah, he tells them to pay their taxes and the Egyptians will protect them. This goes on for 4 years. 4 years of the people of Judah paying taxes to an empire that is not their own. The superpowers of Egypt and Babylon meet in the Battle of Carchemish. And in the Battle of Carchemish, the Babylonians defeat the Egyptians. And when the Egyptians are defeated, they retreat, leaving a vacuum for Babylon to come in and take over Judah. Now, Babylon goes to the king at the time, which is still Jehoiakim, and they say, "Hey, whose side are you on?" And Jehoiakim, being a smart man, says, "Well, I'm on the side of the Babylonians." And so Jehoiakim says, hey, those taxes you were paying to the Egyptians, stop paying to the Egyptians. We're going to pay those instead to the Babylonians. And if we pay taxes to the Babylonians, then they will protect us from people like the Egyptians. This goes on for another 4 years. When Babylon feels like they are powerful enough to invade Egypt. So Babylon mounts an offensive against Egypt and they meet in battle at the border of Egypt in 601 BCE. And wouldn't you know it, the Egyptians hold firm. They then fight off the Babylonians. The Babylonians are forced to retreat. They even withdraw from Judah, which once again creates a vacuum. Egypt walks right into Jerusalem, takes it over, and looks at the king that they installed. And they say, hey, are you going to still pay taxes to Babylon? King Jehoiakim says, nope. And he turns to his people and says, pay your taxes to the Egyptians and they will protect us. So now the people of Judah are paying taxes to the Egyptian Empire once again. This goes on for 1 year. After a year of paying taxes to the Egyptians, we read in 2 Kings 24, in his days, King Jehoiakim's days, King Nebuchadnezzar came up and Jehoiakim became his servant for 3 years. So Jehoiakim then turns to his people once again, now that Judah's been captured by Babylon, and says, pay your taxes to the Babylonians and you will live. And you can imagine that the major political debate that the people of Judah are having is this question: who will save us? Will it be the Egyptians who will save us from the Babylonians? Or will the Babylonians save us from the Egyptians? Because whoever will save us is the one that we should be paying taxes to. So let's recap the reign of King Jehoiakim, shall we? Jehoiakim is made king by the Egyptian Empire. And for 4 years, he taxes the people of Judah to fund the Egyptian military. Then Babylon comes in and Jehoiakim is allowed to be king because he taxes the people of Judah for 4 more years to fund the Babylonian military. Then the Egyptian army comes back in and Jehoiakim spends the 9th year of his reign taxing the people of Judah to fund the Egyptian military. Then the Babylonian military comes in, conquers Judah once again, and Jehoiakim is allowed to be king as long as he takes taxes for 3 years from his own people and puts it toward the Babylonian military. So Jehoiakim is tired of being a puppet king. So tired that he rebels against the king of Babylon and the Babylonian Empire. He begins to tell his people that Egypt will save us, to which Babylon hears this and says, no, they won't. And they begin to put military pressure on Judah. Now, at this point, Jehoiakim is banking on Egypt showing up because, you know, Jehoiakim and Judah have paid a lot of taxes to Egypt. But Egypt sees this, and after seeing so much war, they look at this situation, they say, nah, we're good, we're not showing up. And when Egypt doesn't show up, Babylon takes Jehoiakim off the throne and ends up slaughtering him. Now the people of Judah are frustrated, as you can imagine. So they take Jehoiakim's son, a man named Jehoiachin, I know it's confusing, but Jehoiachin, and they place him on the throne. This makes Babylon mad. Why? Because Babylon did not approve of Jehoiachin being on the throne. And in order to make a point, Babylon comes in with full force in 597 BCE. They light Jerusalem on fire, they take holy relics from the temple, and they take 10,000 of the best and the brightest and the wealthiest from Judah and force them to come live with them in Babylon and to intermarry with their own, making them Babylonian citizens. This is known as the exile, and it is a devastating chapter within Judah and Israel's history. On their way out, Babylon appoints another man king, a man named Zedekiah, who is Josiah's other son and Jehoiakim's brother. Zedekiah takes the throne on 597 BCE to rule over what is left of Judah. Now, Zedekiah is Judah's last king. So here is when things are looking extremely grim. And it's here, under the reign of Zedekiah, that our story in Jeremiah 37 to 39 begins. Verse 1 of chapter 37 reads this: Zedekiah, son of Josiah, whom King Nebuchadnezzar of Babylon made king in the land of Judah, succeeded Jehoiachin, son of Jehoiakim. So the story goes like this. Zedekiah was sitting on the throne, and he wanted the blessing of God through his prophet Jeremiah. So Zedekiah sent two messengers, a man named Jehukal and Shelemiah, to go and find Jeremiah, who was in hiding because he was at odds with the state. So Jehukal and Shelemiah go and find Jeremiah, and they ask if Jeremiah has any prophecy for them and the nation of Judah. In verse 9, we read these words. Jeremiah says, "Thus says the Lord, do not deceive yourselves, saying the Babylonians will surely go away from us, for they will not go away. Even if you defeated the whole army of Babylonians who are fighting against you, and there remained of them only wounded men in their tents, the Babylonians would still rise up and burn this city with fire." In other words, Jeremiah believes that God is telling the nation of Judah to submit to Babylon, much like we talked about last week on this podcast. So Jeremiah makes this prediction that Babylon will win, so it's best that we side with them now. And in the short term, Jeremiah's prediction does not come true. Because shortly after making this prophecy, Babylon sees the Egyptian army coming up and rising against the Babylonians in battle at Judah. And the Babylonians don't want to fight, so they just withdraw from Judah, and the Egyptians march right in. And once again, the ravaged nation of Judah is now under Egyptian control. Jeremiah, who has been supportive of the Babylonian Empire from day one, sees this and freaks out a little bit. So much so that he tries to escape from the city until a guard named Erijah sees him and says, "Halt! You, Jeremiah, are deserting to the Babylonians." This is not a surprising accusation, because Jeremiah has been voicing his support for Babylon from the beginning. Jeremiah hears the accusation and responds by saying, "No, I am not deserting to the Babylonians." But Erijah doesn't care. He arrests him, throws him in prison, and then we read about how Jeremiah is beaten mercilessly by the state officials. Jeremiah is the victim of police brutality in his day. And after receiving blow after blow and barely being able to breathe, Jeremiah then is thrown down a cistern and left there to die. After a few days, King Zedekiah sends for this weak and poor and hurting prophet. He sends word for Jeremiah. Jeremiah is pulled up from the cistern, brought into the palace before the king of Zedekiah. And Zedekiah asks him the question, "Is there any word from the Lord?" Jeremiah responds by saying, "Yes, there is." Now, at this point, we assume that Zedekiah is hoping that Jeremiah will change his mind, that Jeremiah will finally switch allegiances because he has been at death's door. And Jeremiah will say, "God has changed God's mind, and now God is on the side of the Egyptians." But that's not what Jeremiah says. In verse 17 of chapter 37, he says, "You, Zedekiah, shall be handed over to the king of Babylon." That is the word of the Lord. After sharing that word from God, Jeremiah then asks Zedekiah for mercy. He implores the king to treat him with kindness. And what's surprising is the king does. King Zedekiah does not send him back to the cistern, but we read something different in verse 21. We read, "So King Zedekiah gave orders, and they committed Jeremiah to the court of the guard, and a loaf of bread was given to Jeremiah daily from the baker's street until all the bread of the city was gone." Now, it's important for us to remember that last sentence, that he was given bread until all the bread was gone. It's important for us to remember this because Judah was a starving nation. They had been destroyed and decimated and deposed after decades of war. And so here's this poor little nation barely hanging on, and they're having internal quarrels about where God was leading. And here they give bread until it runs out to someone who disagrees with them. This is a nation with its back against the wall. There isn't much hope in the nation of Judah at this time. And with Egypt looming over them, there is this sense that maybe they will be here today, but they may not be here tomorrow. That is how chapter 37 closes. And then chapter 38 begins. We are introduced to four religious and state officials: Shephatiah, Gedaliah, Jukal, and Pashur. These four go before King Zedekiah, and they are mad that Zedekiah gets bread. The words they use to talk to King Zedekiah are found in verse 4 when they say, "This man, Jeremiah, ought to be put to death because he is discouraging the soldiers who are left in the city and all the people by speaking such words to them. For this man is not seeking the welfare of his people, but their harm." And they are frustrated that Jeremiah is still saying we should support Babylon, even though Egypt is the one who is currently overseeing them. And so Zedekiah hears their request, and we assume that Zedekiah will say, "No, he asked me for mercy, and I am a merciful king, and I'm the king, and that's my word, and it's final." But instead, he says, "Here he is. He is in your hands, for the king is powerless against you." So these four guys, Shephatiah, Gedaliah, Jukal, and Pashur, take Jeremiah and once again throw him down the cistern. And they leave him in the cistern to once again die. But after a couple days, an Ethiopian eunuch in the court, a man named Ebed-Melech, sees the injustice that happened to Jeremiah. He goes before the king and begs for Jeremiah's life. Zedekiah once again relents and allows Ebed-Melech to go and save Jeremiah out of the cistern. So he lowers some ropes, brings Jeremiah out of the cistern, and as soon as he's out of the cistern, Zedekiah once again sends for Jeremiah. And when Jeremiah goes before the king, Zedekiah says to him, "I have something to ask you. Do not hide anything from me." Jeremiah responds to this request as I think I would if I had gone through this same situation. Jeremiah says, "If I tell you, you will put me to death, will you not? And if I give you advice, then you will not listen to me." Zedekiah swears that he will not put Jeremiah to death. His words are found in verse 16 when he says to Jeremiah, "As the Lord lives who gave us our lives, I will not put you to death or hand you over to those men who seek your life." Jeremiah hears this pledge and then decides to share what he believes God is telling him to Zedekiah. Jeremiah says, "Thus says the Lord, the God of hosts, the God of Israel, if you will only surrender to the officials of the king of Babylon, then your life shall be spared, and this city shall not be burned with fire, and you and your house shall live. But if you do not surrender, Zedekiah, to the officials of the king of Babylon, then this city shall be handed over to the Babylonians, and they shall burn it with fire, and you yourself shall not escape from their hand." Jeremiah does not waver. He still believes that God is asking them to submit to Babylon, to trust that Babylon will win this war, and that is what will save Judah. Zedekiah hears this advice, he thinks about it, and then he says to Jeremiah, "Do not let anyone else know of this conversation, or you will die." After Zedekiah sends Jeremiah away, he thinks about the words he's heard from the prophet and decides to disregard them. He decides to continue to support Egypt. And this is where chapter 38 ends. Chapter 39 begins with Babylon's military returning to Judah. The Babylonians are ticked because they were chased out of Judah. And so to make a statement that they will be the ones that rule this plot of land before the Egyptians, they come back with a military in full force. The Egyptian army sees the Babylonians on the horizon. They freak out and they quickly abandon Judah. They leave Judah for the taking and allow Judah to fight for itself. Judah swears that it will never give in to the Babylonians. And so they hunker down, they close the doors, they batten down the hatches, and they prepare for a storm from the Babylonians. But the Babylonians don't attack. They simply surround the city of Jerusalem and place it under siege. No food or water can go into the city, and no human can go out. This siege lasts for 18 months, and the people of Judah inside Jerusalem are starving to death. It's at this point that Babylon decides to attack. And after some time, they breach one of the walls and they march on Jerusalem in 586 BCE. They light anything they can find on fire and they capture Jerusalem. They march straight to the palace without much interruption or opposition. And when they arrive there, they find King Zedekiah and his family. They capture the king and the royal family, and they take them back to King Nebuchadnezzar, who is commanding the army of Babylon. The Babylonians then take King Zedekiah, they throw him before King Nebuchadnezzar, and they open his eyes, they force him to watch as they murder each of his children right in front of his face. After watching this horrendous evil unfold, they then turn to Zedekiah and they don't kill him. No, 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 that would be much too merciful for Babylonians. Instead, they take a sword and they gouge out his eyes. And they want the last thing that Zedekiah sees to be the murder of his children. From that moment forward, for the rest of his life, Zedekiah serves as a blind slave within the Babylonian Empire. Judah is destroyed. Jerusalem is in rubble. And that is how chapter 39 and this story ends. Which raises the question, what do we do with this barbaric and tragic story? This story is rarely discussed among Christians today. This is a story where God feels very distant and absent from people who are suffering. This is a story where the people who we consider to be the good guys don't win. This is a story about violence so grotesque that it questions whether or not humanity is worth saving, or whether humanity is good. What do we do with this barbaric and tragic story? And is there anything we can take from its pages soaked in tears and blood? Well, when I read this story, I'm reminded of an event that happened not too long ago within American history. Now, this event has recently come to my attention because I have watched a docuseries on this event, and it was fascinating. The event I'm speaking of is the Vietnam War, captured in a docuseries entitled The Vietnam War, a film by Ken Burns and Lynn Novick. Now, what Burns and Novick do that is so well executed is they're able to tell the story of the soldiers and have that be where the humanity of the story is. Now, they also take elevated views at politics and what led to world leaders creating this conflict, but this story is mostly told from the perspective of the soldier. And when it's that personal, when the soldier stories are brought to that much focus and that much light, the war and the violence that ensues seems barbaric and tragic. And at the same time, I admire the courage of the soldiers who did what they thought was best for their country and did whatever they could to do what was right. While the reasons we fought in Vietnam are obviously confusing, what should not be confusing is how we remember and appreciate and honor those who served and were wounded, and those who died. Every human being involved in the conflict in Vietnam, regardless of what side they were on, was ultimately a child of God. And when children of God are killed in a war, then it raises all kinds of questions as to why we were fighting that war, and it makes the stakes of that war so much higher. And when I watched this film by Burns and Novick and what it exemplified, one thing that they kept highlighting that stuck with me and I can't stop thinking about is the attitudes and the motivations of the American presidents who oversaw the war. So a quick background on the war. In 1954, there was a peace convention in Geneva that divided the country of Vietnam into two, a northern half, which would be given to the communist government, and a southern half, which would be given to the democratic government, which means the United States of America had a lot of interest in keeping the South Vietnamese government in place in order to protect a democratic country within Southeast Asia. In 1960, John Kennedy was elected by the American people to be president of the United States of America. The president before him, Eisenhower, had deployed military aid and advisors to live in Vietnam to help defend the country from the North Vietnamese army. Shortly after Kennedy took office, he increased U.S. military aid and advisors in South Vietnam by a factor of 18. But while he was increasing aid and advisors within South Vietnam, he kept getting intel back saying how impossible it would be to win this war. Not only that, how much the South Vietnamese resented the American government, the aid that the government was providing, and the advisors, the American advisors that the American government kept sending over. And it got so bad that at one point, John Kennedy turned to a friend and he said these words, "These people, the South Vietnamese, hate us. They are going to throw our butts out of Vietnam at almost any point. But I can't give up a piece of territory like Vietnam to the communists and then get the people to reelect me." A few months after saying these words, John F. Kennedy was assassinated in Texas in 1963. His vice president, Lyndon Baines Johnson, took on the role of being the president of the United States of America. Johnson inherited Vietnam and was uncertain of what to do with this territory, with this country, and with these people. There was all sorts of advisors who were telling him to send more troops in, and other advisors telling him to withdraw troops from Vietnam. Less than a year into his presidency in 1964, an election year, a newspaper reporter asked Johnson what kind of intel and advice he was receiving about Vietnam and what he was going to do with the American involvement in Vietnam. Johnson responded with these words. They say, "Get in or get out." And I told them, "We haven't got any Congress that will go with us into the war. And we haven't got any mothers that will go with us in a war. And I'm just a trustee. I've got to win an election and then I can make a decision." Well, Johnson won that election. And Johnson was the first president then who sent ground troops into Vietnam en masse. American casualties began to rise. Johnson was desperate for a way out of Vietnam or a victory in Vietnam and didn't see a way to either. The war and the death weighed heavily on Lyndon Johnson, so heavily that he shocked the United States of America by telling them that he would not run for re-election in 1968. With Johnson out of the running, the people of America chose Richard Nixon as the next president of the United States of America. Now, a major strategy within the Nixon administration when it came to Vietnam was the Vietnamization of the war. Vietnamization was the idea that the South Vietnamese would fight their own war and that we could withdraw American troops and the South Vietnamese army could defend themselves against other nations. So Nixon repeatedly in public would tell the American people about how strong and how powerful and how mighty the South Vietnamese army was. But then when it got to private conversations with his cabinet, he would say something entirely different. In a recorded phone conversation between Henry Kissinger, the National Security Advisor, and Richard Nixon, the President of the United States, we found out how Nixon really felt about the South Vietnamese Army. Henry Kissinger said these words to Nixon. He said, "I must tell you honestly, now that I've seen the operation, this South Vietnamese Army is not as good as we all thought." Nixon responded by saying, "We knew the South Vietnamese Army wasn't that good. I'm with you. But Henry, I have become completely fatalistic about the goddamn thing. I don't think that the South Vietnamese Army is up to a real bang. I don't think they're up for it." Kissinger responded by saying, "That's what worries me." Nixon went on to say, "And if the South Vietnamese are not up to it, I don't want them to take a hell of a bang. I'd rather have them get out, and then we're going to get the hell out and hope and pray that nothing happens before 1972. What happens in 1972? An election! Nixon goes on to say, "Let's face it, if my re-election is important, let's remember that I've got to get this off of our plate." Three different presidents had three different conversations about how Vietnam could help them get re-elected. And the decision-making process that they had was not what is the right thing, but what will help me with voters in the United States of America. And the reason these conversations were so hard for me to hear was because I've been to the Vietnam Veterans Memorial. I've seen the names that were given as a sacrifice for this cause. And the death toll still weighs heavy on American history. And when we hear these three different conversations with trusted advisors and these presidents sharing about how the most important thing is I get reelected, it's like we want one of the advisors to lean in close to them and say, "Hey, can I tell you something? It's okay if you don't get reelected." Like, obviously, you want to get reelected and I want you to get reelected, but understand that's not the worst case scenario, right? The worst case scenario is that you do something immoral in order to get reelected. The worst case scenario is you send people to their death so that you can hold on to power. The worst case scenario is that you are so consumed by power that you cannot ask yourself what is right. It's okay if you don't get reelected. When historians talk about the Vietnam War, something that always comes up is hubris or the ego or the pride of the American people and the American government in their military. There was this sense that we could not lose any war. And then the Vietnam War happened, and we didn't know how to say we can't win this. The ego is a dangerous thing, isn't it? The great Richard Rohr once wrote in his book, Falling Upward, "The human ego prefers anything, just about anything, to falling or changing or dying." When we talk about an American ego, what we're talking about is we don't like the idea that we need to change or adapt to the ways of the world. We like to tell the world how things are going to be, right? And when we talk about the ego, we so often think of a negative thing, but I've learned in my life that the ego isn't always negative. There's a lot of times it's a very positive thing. And rather than trying to get rid of all of my ego, there is a much more important balance that we have to find within our own egos. When we talk about the balance of the ego, if we talk about someone that is loaded with ego and can only focus on themselves, well, that is a person that we talk about as arrogant or selfish or inconsiderate. Now, what is the opposite of someone who is filled to the brim with their own ego? So often people think the opposite of someone filled to the brim of their own ego is someone who is humble. But I haven't found that to be true. Because someone who has zero ego, who has zero sense of importance, who can't believe that they're worth anybody's time, is not someone who is humble, but instead is someone who has very low self-esteem, who has low self-worth, who feels like there is no hope, who feels like they can't make a difference or change things. Someone who is filled with despair, isn't it? So the important thing is to recognize that the ego is the thing that gives us a sense of purpose, that gives us the audacity to believe that we can actually change the way things are. And it's really hard to change the way things are unless we change ourselves first. So somewhere between despair and arrogance is the perfect balance of ego, which I would call humility. And in this case, I would define humility as appreciation for others and for yourself. Now, this is not a thing where you just think to yourself, well, I need to balance my ego and you can master it tomorrow. This takes a lifetime of work, right? And there's times that we can't see when our ego has depleted us or when our ego has run amok. And there's times that our ego blinds us to our own weaknesses because we're trying to convince ourselves that we're greater than we actually are. Or there's times that our ego deceives us and abandons us when we need to remind ourselves that we are worthwhile. It's with that in mind, that balance of the ego, that we return to this story, this tragic and barbaric story, and we go to the part of the story where Jeremiah is thrown down the cistern for the second time. Ebed-Melech goes and rescues him from there, and then Zedekiah sends for him, and Zedekiah stands before Jeremiah the second time. Both of them are just moments away from death, it feels like. And Zedekiah says these words in Jeremiah 38:14. He says, "Jeremiah, I have something to ask you. Do not hide anything from me." You know what this is? This is a man who is trying to balance his ego. This is a king who longs to hear something that is difficult to hear so he can change something. This is called vulnerability. And vulnerability is necessary to balance one's ego. At this point, Jeremiah can say anything, and it may be a hurtful thing, it may be a terrible thing, it may be something that is not true. But Zedekiah is trying desperately to balance his own ego. Now, Jeremiah responds with his advice. Zedekiah chooses to disregard that advice, but I never want us to forget this moment of vulnerability. It is essential. It is necessary for all of us to have moments like this. And I think that the question that this story dares us to ask is this: who do I trust to tell me difficult things? Who do you trust to tell you difficult things? We all need to hear these difficult things at some point in our lives, don't we? We need to hear about when we've been selfish, or when we've been arrogant, or when we've run people over. We need to hear about the times that we have been inconsiderate of others. And the best way to hear those difficult things is from relationships that you trust to tell you those difficult things. And our ego will tell us to withdraw from those relationships, to not trust what the person is saying. But the fact is, when we're talking about balancing our ego, those moments of vulnerability, those relationships where we can be vulnerable and ask for difficult things to be told to us, are essential, are necessary to balancing our own ego. Now, the question becomes, who do I trust to tell me these difficult things? I have found one question separates who I trust from who I do not. And the question is simply this: is this person who is willing to tell me difficult things genuinely interested in my success? Is this a person who will be jealous if I were to succeed? Well, then I probably shouldn't ask them to tell me difficult things. Is this a person who is stuck by me through thick and thin and genuinely supports and celebrates when something good happens to me? Well, then I trust them to tell me something difficult because this person wants me to succeed as much as I do. And if somebody comes to you and asks you to tell them difficult things, and you start to question yourself as to whether or not you should tell them something difficult, I would encourage you to ask yourself this question: am I genuinely interested in this person's success? If the answer is no, then don't tell them difficult things. It's not fair to them. But if someone is really genuinely interested in your success and they have no strings attached, they don't profit off you succeeding, instead they just love you and they want you to be all that God has created you to be, then that is a relationship that you need to hold on to. That is a relationship that I need to hold on to. Because we should all be able to answer the question, who do I trust to tell me difficult things? Because those difficult things are obviously difficult to hear. And yet we need to hear those at all times. If presidents are not immune from needing to hear these difficult things, like it's okay if you don't get reelected, if the king of Judah needs to hear that he's not going to win the war against the Babylonians, then you and I also need to be able to hear these things as well. Because when I look at the story of Jeremiah and Zedekiah and presidents during the Vietnam War, the thing I'm reminded of is that vulnerability is necessary. Vulnerability is necessary. My brothers and sisters, may you grow and tend and savor and embrace relationships with people that are genuinely interested in your success. And may you trust them to tell you difficult things. And may you balance your own ego. Amen.